do a Google search on hot flashes, my God. It's very clear that there is no or very little information as a resource for women to figure out, what the heck do I do? Do I do hormone replacement therapy or not?
A passionate champion of the data-empowered citizen, Linda Avey rocked the world with her first startup, consumer genetics company 23andMe. What's next for her? We are curious.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Shaywitz. Lisa, I know you just returned from this year's HIMSS meeting feeling very differently than you did several years ago.
Yeah.
What's changed?
Yeah, you remember a couple years ago I went straight from South by Southwest to HIMSS. And
you were struck by the
culture
contrast.
Clash was a little frightening.
But it sounds like things have evolved in a positive direction.
I think they have, actually. I was really struck by the presence of the consumer or the patient as the focus of HIMSS this year, intentionally to a certain extent, but also unintentionally. And there was a really heavy emphasis on how the patient should be at the center of attention in the delivery of care, which is kind of a duh, right? But not so much for the health IT.
But from what you were describing, it sounded like, well, that, you know, people have always discussed that and sort of, you know, nominally said, oh, of course, it's all about the patient and the children.
Right. But making the world a better place.
And making the world a better place. But I mean, your impression coming back from it was that people somehow have actually started believing this and really acting upon it.
Yeah.
Reason to be.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more people drinking the Kool-Aid than there used to be. And I was... just the whole tenor of the crowd at HIMSS, and the HIMSS crowd's huge. It's 42,000 people.
Are your best friends?
Yeah, 42,000 of my closest friends. But the even the people who were there, and the types of companies, and the, you know, you even saw people like you would at South by Southwest walking around with blue and purple hair, and but people, you know, like the huge parade of people wearing Regina Holliday's walking gallery jackets, which are the story of patient experience individually, and how that was, you know, really lauded as a central theme throughout the conference in such a different way. I was there a couple of years ago, and I wrote that story at the start of our book back in 2012, and it was all epic. It was all about epic.
Right.
You know, everything at the conference was EMR-focused and nothing really focused on what the patient would do or care about.
Well, that's incredibly optimistic, and let's hope that this trend continues. So I want to start by talking about this. From the time of Mendel, through the elucidation of the structure of DNA by Franklin, Crick, Watson, and Wilkins, and certainly since the genome was first sequenced over a decade ago, genetics has absolutely captivated us. We are enthralled, but also unnerved by its potential, and wonder what the information contained within our DNA reveals or doesn't reveal about us and our future. Linda Avey has been at the tip of the spear here. The first company she co-founded, 23andMe, has been the prism through which many of us have been introduced to the challenges around genomic information. One of the most significant events in the history of 23andMe, what's been described as a, quote, scathing, unquote, warning letter from the FDA, arrived in November of 2013, several years after Linda had left 23andMe to pursue a new company, We Are Curious, which we'll talk about in a moment. So my first question, Linda, is do you remember where you were when you heard about the 2013 FDA letter, and what was the first thing that went through your mind?
Well, I do remember very distinctly. I was up quite early. I'm an early bird, and so I got wind of this, I think through a Google alert. I have it set up for everything that comes out in the news about 23andMe, and so I opened that up and probably jumped up from my desk and started pacing around the house. It was probably like 5 a.m, which is usually when I get up, and immediately started emailing a bunch of people and trying to figure out what the heck was going on. So it was as much a surprise to me as I think it was the rest of the world.
But you were gone from the company by this point, right?
I was gone from the company completely, yeah. No longer on the board, so didn't really have day-to-day engagement with any of the people, the managers, or anyone. But it was really, what was maddening about it was that we'd had ongoing conversations. When I was still at 23andMe, we'd been to the FDA many times and had this ongoing discussion. And so it was baffling to me that suddenly it could have come to this, that having had this conversation and this communication going on, it's like, what could have possibly caused such a dramatic letter to be written? And so that's what I was trying to get to the bottom of when I was reaching out to people who had better information. Yeah, I think I did. And I actually did an interview, I think it was with I forget the journalist at the New York Times, but just gave my honest assessment of what was going on. And I think it literally was that there just weren't people paying attention and were not communicating anymore or as as frequently as we were trying to in the earlier days. But I also, in defense of 23andMe, there could have been a level of frustration that it just didn't seem to be going anywhere. And maybe, looking back on this and always trying to put a positive spin on things, maybe this is really a good thing that this happened, because it brought it all to a head, and it really forced both sides of the equation here to come together and figure out a path forward, which is what I think we're seeing now.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about that. So do you feel, you know, a couple of years later, now you hear that, you know, that the FDA not only approved the Bloom syndrome screening, but also more generally said, oh, and by the way, if you want to have consumer screening for recessive traits, go for it.
Yes, exactly. And so that there's a whole lot of content there that we can start to reanalyze and hopefully put through a more efficient channel with the FDA to get each one of these reports, because there are numerous, as you know, there are so many recessive traits that people potentially could carry, and they just have no idea that it's residing in their genome until they do this kind of testing. And so it's to me, that's a very, very big step.
So the consumer, we started off this conversation about the consumer and at HIMSS and their intersection with technologies was the focus of that conference. And this is clearly, you know, that, right? This whole genetic
Absolutely.
Discussion. And I find it so interesting because most people, I think, really don't care about this level of knowledge about themselves and, in fact, spend most of their time in denial about the conditions they actually know they have. So who is the person that actually cares about this information about themselves? What are they like?
Well, I guess I would push back a little bit on this idea that people aren't interested in this. And I do think that that might be the initial reaction people have. But the minute their data are sitting in front of them and they can actually start wading through it, it changes the whole equation. Everyone that I've talked to has at least some interest in, a lot of it has to do with the interface of how do you present this information in an interesting way. Because you could do it in a really boring way that doesn't engage people. But if you can figure out a way to create that interface that draws them in and I think looks broadly across the genome, not just at your health and the scary risks that you might have, but the ancestry piece is really interesting to most people. They find at least some nugget of information that they may not have known about. So I'm
hoping to find I'm related to George Clooney so I can reach out to him directly. But
then you couldn't marry him.
That's okay.
He is taken for now. But.
But it is sort of a fine line, isn't it, between on the one hand people wanting to know, you know, and you wanting to engage patients, but on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of consequences to the knowledge. There's an article in the Boston Globe that I'm sure you saw where they talked about essentially misinterpretation of genetic screening tests, where there was an example where some people were getting a preliminary test that was supposed to then lead to more advanced testing, but everyone didn't go on to the advanced testing, and some people just terminated pregnancy at that point. And then other people, even if they had subsequent testing that showed that the kid was fine, these were prenatal screening tests, one of the parents apparently said that they just couldn't get past the genetic test, and just seeing that result there was just sort of just they couldn't think after that, they said.
Well, there are going to be these kinds of issues, but I would challenge that perspective to say that having more information is going to be better than having less information, and there are going to have to be the channels that we figure out how to deal with these issues that do crop up, because they absolutely will. But the end game has got to be that more information is better.
Absolutely.
Is there a circumstance where this has proven out to be true? Have you interacted with a patient or a consumer where they've gone past this experience?
There was definitely a situation, and this was more about whether or not somebody was going to decide to do the testing at all. And we had a conversation with a gentleman. It was early on, and he just said, I have no interest in this whatsoever. Why would I want to do this? And then one of his children was diagnosed with a disease, and it completely changed everything. And I think the 23andMe mission around research, rather than saying we know everything, it's more about we're trying to figure this stuff out. And the more people we can have involved in this, the hopefully the sooner we're going to do that. And so I think that's what really changed his perspective, was that, oh, now that my child has this condition, I can find other families who share this with us, and we can all come together as a team and as a community and try to figure this out together.
I mean, it really does seem like two totally different populations, though obviously they're not. When you think about sort of the people who are patients or family of patients, I mean, they're all in. They want more research. They want more understanding. The wonderful work you've done with Parkinson's seems like an example of that. But then you have the people who may or may not have something, but that's not why they're in it. It's sort of their, you know, it's more curiosity, or maybe they're not curious, like you were suggesting, maybe they should be. What do you, you know, for them, you know, it seems more the benefits are less clear for them in their minds.
Absolutely. And there are some people who do go through the experience and they learn what they can, and it's not that interesting. In fact, I was doing an interview with Martin from Nightline. I can't remember his last name. But he was on tape. So we were being filmed and he was getting his data for the first time. And he was so nervous and just sweating. And
oh my gosh.
And then we went through, literally looking through, and I was kind of nervous because you don't know what you're going to find, right? But at the end of it, he was actually really disappointed because his genetics looked great. There was really nothing there that was that exciting.
No story to break.
Oh,
exactly.
My gosh. No, honestly, there's nothing you'd rather be than a boring patient,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And it's actually a good
thing.
But
that was Venter's experience, too, wasn't it? I mean, in his book, he says, you know, he got a whole genome sequence, and he learned really, you know, he tries to, you know, in autobiography, he tries to find some examples of learning. But basically, he said, you know, meh.
Yeah, exactly. So that's good news. That's a good thing for people to find out. It is disappointing because it's not more interesting to them, I guess. But then I think what also is a factor is that people then realize they can be healthy controls in research studies around diseases. So let's say two sisters do 23andMe. One finds out she's BRCA positive. That has its own, all the, you know, the things that are associated with that. The other sister finds out she doesn't have it, but she can be a healthy control in a study with her sister. So there are so many ways that you can turn this into a positive experience.
But how many people, just to play devil's advocate, have it as their life goal to be a test subject, right? I mean, they really aren't. Most people aren't interested in that.
If you have a sibling or a family member, though, who's afflicted by something, then all of a sudden it becomes more interesting to you, I would think.
And if you don't really have to do anything at all other than answer a survey that says, I don't have Parkinson's disease, that's such a simple contribution, but it's hugely important. Mm-hmm. And it's all about communicating how important that is in doing that kind of research where you've got case control study design, and the controls are just as important, if not more, than the cases. And if you can have twice as many control or cases or controls, three times, four times, it adds to the power of the
sure,
study.
Absolutely.
So that's something that is, if it's communicated well, it really does, I think, give people that feeling like I'm doing something.
So you're obviously so passionate about this. How did you then decide to leave the company and to do something else?
So it's a long story and it's complicated as these things are, but
I would life
say,
can be that way.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing that I found myself doing already when I was still at 23andMe was starting to think about, okay, what's next? And I was thinking along the lines of what the new company is building at 23andMe. And in fact, I went to one of our designers and sat down with her and said, can we build this little tool that allows people to start tracking things like a little diary? And she got excited about it. So we spent a little time talking it through, and our head of engineering got wind of it and just said, done, over,
yeah.
We don't have the bandwidth. And he was absolutely right. But that was really where I got those wheels turning of how do we collect all this other information from people beyond their genetics and beyond just the surveys that 23andMe
like what sorts
out.
Of information were you thinking of?
Well, a little tool that said what drugs you took every day and what symptoms you had and what you've been diagnosed with. So just a way for you to gather that information yourself, but then that gets layered on top of your genetic data. And so it goes beyond the surveys that people are filling out at 23andMe, which is hugely valuable because it's very consistent and everybody fills out the same survey. So it's very standardized in that sense. But I was just feeling like, well, there's all this phenotypic data that's all around us that if we could capture that in some way, that could really add to the experiment.
So cool idea, conceptually brilliant, you know, to know all that data together, the phenotypic, the genotypic, et cetera.
Right.
And yet, time and time again, every company that has tried to get patients to input their data has failed.
Exactly. And so what the new thing is, I think now, is the advent of all the wearables that
right.
are coming onto the market and the ways that we can passively start to collect data that we didn't have before. And so anything that requires a lot of manual tracking where people are actually having to take time out of their day to input the information, that's not going to work. People just aren't, it's too much behavior change to expect that. But if we can start implementing these wearables and having sensors in our environment, that data will just start to pile up. And what can we do to make it more meaningful?
But until you have sensors in the drugs themselves, you're not going to get the drug compliance data or the drug information
without
the patient's information.
But we have companies like Proteus now where that is starting to happen. So,
right,
yeah.
In a limited basis. But it's going to be a pretty long time before you get that broadly across medicines.
Well, but I think the other part of, or the way we're looking at this field is that there are a lot of people who have a lot of health issues who aren't taking any drugs. Mm-hmm. That's not really there. It's all this chronic stuff, and it's sort of at the fringes of
clinical care. Yeah, so help us understand some of these sort of, I wouldn't want to even call it use cases, because that's sort of, you know, sort of the
that's entrepreneur what we
think
it,
about
yeah.
it. Yeah. Yeah. No, but like the patients who you're thinking of trying to help
the
with
human
your,
beings side
the, yeah, the people. The,
what you might call human beings, right?
You and Terry Gross.
Yeah, right.
No, but it's funny because I've seen, you know, you've discussed this, you know, really, really passionately. Could you just maybe sort of for the listeners sort of describe some of the, you know, sort of categories or patients or types of illnesses that you've been focusing on?
Yeah, so we've been...
And this is for We Are Curious.
Yes, exactly. So in this new capacity in the new company, we've been really spending a lot of time looking at the conditions where there may not be a treatment. There may not even be an exact diagnosis, such as chronic fatigue. That's an area where we've spent a lot of time looking at that condition. I wouldn't even call it a disease necessarily. And this is another thing that I started thinking about a lot when I was doing some early research studies in conditions where... We were looking at it from very much a genetics angle, and it would just be like, oh, let's do a study of autism and bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, and we would look for biorepositories where we could pluck DNA samples out, put them in a machine, and voila, we'd have our answer, right? That did not work out that well, not surprisingly. And so what really became a defining moment for me, we were getting ready to submit a grant for an autism study, and I got wind of this walk that was going on in San Francisco for to raise money for autism research. And so I thought, you know, I'll go to that and just see what this community is all about. And so I got there, and I was just thunderstruck by the difference in the phenotype. So some of the little kids, and so it was families with children with autism, some of the kids were running circles around their parents, and some were in wheelchairs. Some were talking and rattling off, and some were mute that weren't talking at all. And so it was very clear that this label autism was just kind of a placeholder, because we really don't know what this condition is. And it's a spectrum disorder. We've gotten better at sort of saying we don't really know what
there
it is.
There is a spectrum, not just a disorder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is probably true with chronic fatigue. There's probably a spectrum to MS, to rheumatoid arthritis even. And the
Absolutely.
Patients know this. And so I think that's where we've gotten to this point of patients being more at the center of things, because they're demanding it, because they know the labels don't fit, the drugs don't always work. And they're left sort of holding the bag of all this information of, you know, I know about my condition, and I know it's not the same as this other person who has the same disease label I have. So what's up with that?
Well, it's interesting, because we earlier in a different show interviewed John D'Souza. And he talked about how his child had been given a drug for asthma, basically, and that they couldn't help the child sleep properly, that he'd basically been given too strong a dose, and that they used Fitbit data on sleep and other homegrown data, you know, tracking to titrate the drug. He did it, you know,
wow.
Where he couldn't get the doctor to do it until they got it right. And it was really kind of an interesting story about, you know, somebody using the, you know, the guerrilla approach to data analysis, phenotypic and phenotypic data,
right,
to do the right thing for their child, where the medical system had essentially not quite got them there.
And that's probably one of the strongest relationships of between parent and child. And as parents, we will do everything for our kids, right? And luckily for John, he had some data that he could work with, right?
And
either
the
job on a Fitbit.
Mind to look at it that
exactly.
way. Exactly. He went to MIT so he can look at data.
Right. Well, so part of this consortium of or this family group of families here in the Bay Area that have kids with autism, they're doing a very similar thing. And one family, the mom is. She's created a little classroom in her home, and she is monitoring the temperature in the room. And she found that when the temperature is lower, her daughter does better. So that's something she would have never discovered without having now this sort of Internet of Things and starting to look at data in a very analytical way to say, okay, why was her behavior better on these days? What was different? What else was going on in the environment? And seeing, oh wow, it was cooler in the room.
How interesting. You know, you talked to me earlier about how you started out with We Are Curious thinking about the focus on perimenopause and menopause.
Yes.
How that didn't go so well.
You're even going to bring that up?
I am going to bring it up. Oh, my God. Women's health.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, it was very interesting.
I'm going there.
And I'll be very honest. I'm 55 years old, and so this is partly my own personal story. Mm-hmm. But when you go through this time of your life, it's really rocky, and there's a lot of stuff going on. And if you are informed enough to go and read the Women's Health Initiative studies, and you start to read in Google, and you look, you know, just do a Google search on hot flashes, my God. And it's very clear that there is no or very little information out there for as a resource for women to figure out, what the heck do I do? Do I do hormone replacement therapy or not? Do I want to increase my risk for breast cancer and heart disease, or do I just survive these hot flashes all day long? What do I do, right? And so the more I looked into it, you just realize there really isn't a lot there. There aren't a lot of resources. And so that was one of the sort of use cases, if you want to call it that, that I was really interested in pursuing with We Are Curious.
And of course, it's a big market.
It's the largest demographic in the U.S. I did some work on Facebook to look. So there are apparently 45 million women of this age group, 45 to 60 or thereabouts. 22 million are on Facebook. Shockingly. So this is, it's just a prime market to start to tap. So I thought the VC community would just be like, woohoo, this is perfect, this is great. And I have to say, I wasn't met with that same excitement.
The female VCs didn't love this?
Yeah.
All two of them?
Oh, yeah.
Both of them,
yes,
yeah.
Exactly. I don't think I'd gotten to those two females. I couldn't find them. So yeah, it wasn't resonating.
Really?
But it is interesting because as whatever lack of understanding some of these VCs have, they are interested in big markets and they are interested
exactly.
in making money. So where is this sort of the disconnect? Because, you know, whatever they don't understand, they're very motivated by the numbers that you're describing. So where was the disconnect?
I think it was, as Lisa was saying, it's this women's health sort of ooh factor that...
But we did a show on unmentionables, right? Right. Which is sort of what you're suggesting this
yeah.
is. This is a category of unmentionables. But at the same time, I wonder how you balance that with saying, on the other hand, if people really do like the idea of thinking, quote, differently. I mean, it shouldn't be different if it's affecting so many people.
Right.
But I would think that somebody would have... it's amazing to me, given the opportunity that you're describing, that just out of purely enlightened self-interest, even if people had an ooh reaction, they wouldn't be able to get past that.
Yeah, it was shocking. But the good news is I've met with investors who are not, they are welcoming this idea with open arms, and we're off and running, and it's all great. But that, and what I found out that I had to do was not lead with that. I could kind of present just the platform agnostically, and then as I gauge the person to see, you know, do I think this is going to be a good person to bring up this huge opportunity or not? So I would have to kind of censor myself a little bit.
It's so interesting. I was just doing some research for a client myself about women's cardiovascular health companies, and the research I found is there are no women's cardiovascular health companies.
I know you were begging on Twitter for information.
Yeah, I mean, I was, I got a lot of feedback. The feedback I got was there's nothing.
Wow.
And considering that women, A, are the largest population to go after, and B, experience cardiovascular disease differently than men, you'd have thought maybe somebody might come up with something. And I think I literally came up with one or two companies that had and unintentionally ended up focusing on that and not even intentionally focusing on that, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of a stunning problem, and just the ooh factor, as you, one of you called it, of the perception among the investors for women-focused health deals is that they are so second class.
Mm-hmm.
But is it, just asking... I think
what do
it must
you
know? Be my role. Yeah, right. But is it that, or is it that people are more trying? Is it that there are companies that are trying to just go after the male market, or is it that some of the companies, it's more like they haven't chose to niche it as male or female heart disease, but rather we're coming up with an intervention for heart disease that we're going to customize, whether by gender, whether by other factors, and it's just they've not chosen to go out purely as we are a female cardiovascular company, but rather we're a cardiovascular company, or we're a prevention company, or we're a something, and adjust and having sort of, you know, maybe, and the gender customization is one of many customizations that individual patients might want.
And I think that could be an unintentional bias. So they just come out and say, we're a cardiovascular company, we're coming out with this new drug. But then they do all the testing in men. That typically is what happens. And so unless you kind of...
For drugs or for other interventions? Because
for
drugs...
devices often too.
What?
Often, it used to be also for devices, although now the FDA has, you know, given out more guidance that you have to be more equal. But nevertheless, you can't create a population-wide product for menopause, right? You got to focus,
exactly.
Although, aren't people marketing testosterone for, like, male menopause?
Well, I have
and
to
stuff?
Say, there was one VC I met with who... really this resonated. And he's like, he finally came out and he said, I have hot flashes. And he, you could tell he was really
being... Is it from driving his Ferrari or...
or not fanning himself enough on the golf course?
Yeah, I don't something.
Know. But no, I was really, it was a real honest moment that he had. And I just thought, well, I would love to have something that also deals with these male issues that are also highly unmentionable, right? Mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. they're not going to bring up a weakness like that or however they perceive some of these
aging things. But it just really brings up when you're saying, you know, that the one guy you mentioned, it really connected with him. And, you know, we talk about what are the consequences. We talk about sometimes of having, you know, so few, let's say female VCs, obviously a big topic in the Valley. And I think it's how many decisions at the end of the day are based at least in part on some personal experience that somebody has. Somebody, you know, an investor, such and such thing has always bothered him or such and such thing is something that he's always wanted, you know, whether it's like burgers delivered at midnight or something else. But so if people have never had these sort of broad swath of experiences, then it's not going to occur.
Well, none of these guys' second wives are old enough to have gone through menopause, so they haven't had the personal experience yet.
No, but I'm saying, but this is both an example.
And their mothers didn't talk about it.
It is an example, and in theory, an opportunity, right?
In theory, I think, but you know, your experience is that it's an opportunity.
Unmet opportunity.
That you need to be careful about implementing, right?
Yeah, I almost feel like I have to do it on the sly, that this, I'm not going to talk about it, but the minute we've launched our platform, that is an area that we will definitely
pursue.
Do
you think it's more acceptable in Silicon Valley to be gay than to be a woman?
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know.
You can be a bro.
Exactly.
Yeah. I met with a young guy, yeah, the other day who he's not into the whole bro thing. And I was like, what exactly is that bro thing? And I don't want to go into the details, but he just said he was not interested at all. But it really is it's an environment that you sort of steep yourself in. And there's a lot of things that come with that. And I don't know if you guys watch HBO's Silicon Valley.
Yeah, yeah, we were talking about that.
Oh, yes, bro.
Yeah, that was classic,
but
right?
But I watched that show, and it's almost too real.
That's just what Lisa and I were talking about
it earlier.
It's
like a documentary.
Yeah.
It is a documentary.
Yeah,
it really is. Yeah.
Yeah, more accurate than not, right?
It is. Yeah, they've done a really good job of tapping into this.
I'm going to ask you this other question. One of the things, if I can mention, is that Lisa also said is she thought that the female character that they introduced this season to replace, you know, the poor actor who died, right? Mm-hmm. She thought that that character, this sort of severe female VC, was accurate too.
Yeah, well, I've run into so few female VCs that I don't have a lot of data to work from, but I love that character. It's an example of how
you can play it different ways, but just having a female in, you know, who's a VC doesn't necessarily, I mean, here's someone who is, may have issues of their own.
I thought the best part about that episode, which ran this last Sunday, which was April 19th or something like that.
Thank you for dating our episode.
On April 19th, whenever that was, and relative to today, the advice she gave the younger aspiring partner, VC female, was to change into uglier clothes to deliver the difficult messages. So, you know, the message for me that I took away from that show was that if you're going to be a woman in the Valley in those roles, act like a man, you know, think
Absolutely.
Like a man, behave like a man. And,
well, and that's what the whole Lean In movement to me kind of suggests, that as women, we just have to accept the current climate and the current environment and lean into that. And I would argue that we need to challenge what we're leaning into, because I would say that a lot of women aren't comfortable leaning into something where you have to be the big man on campus and where you have to be the top dog. And it's sort of this whole alpha male structure doesn't fit, frankly, a lot of beta males either. A lot of men aren't comfortable with that environment. And so is there a way for us to kind of turn into more of a Star Trek type world, which would be my dream, where people are more, it's more egalitarian, it's more equal, it's more contribution from everyone. And it's
are there
not
situations or firms or some places you've seen, again, that seem, I know I'm obsessively positive, but where people seem to be doing it right, or examples of whether you might, you know, I hate to say, you know, female role models, or but people who you feel like are no, of course, but I mean, no, but I'm asking you as our guest, if other people who you feel like are sort of acting the way you're describing, you're aspirationally describing.
Not so much here. Luckily, I've met some people in other parts of the world where I think that's much more advanced. And that's been really interesting. And those tend to be the people who I can talk to about menopause and who I can talk to about some of these issues that aren't part of the bro culture that we have here. So absolutely. But I think maybe the U.S., we're a young democracy, relatively, and I think we have a lot of maturing to do.
No, I think this is a good use of collecting data for genotype and phenotype to figure out how do we identify people who can balance the intellect that you need to do these jobs well with the human, you know, skill sets.
EQ and IQ, right?
EQ and IQ, right? Yes. Now, if we could just launch a wearable to identify EQ, now that would be something I think that would be of value to humanity, yeah. Although it would probably never get funded.
Right.
although, by the way, you could argue that part of the issue is that you could say the VCs themselves are a manifestation of the LPs who might even be more uncomfortable with sort of gender diversity and have very specific ideas. And if you show up trying to raise money for a fund from these LPs, they're just for them, that's not what a VC looks like. Right. So in other words, we're seeing one manifestation of this, which I feel like you're accurately describing. But my understanding is that if you even go back a layer to where the money to fund all these VCs are coming from, and then maybe the hope is that there'll be some almost tycoon-funded funds or people will get funds from alternative sources that will really, appreciate and embrace this sort of, and not for sort of, you know, politically correct reasons, but actually what you're describing is there's incredibly good economics that if people actually were, you know, had a much broader view of the world, they would actually do better.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, this has been really interesting. I think, you know, the focus of your work, the genetic side of things, is such a new area for most people. And I think how we take that data and use it practically and make it meaningful for people is in the end the most important thing, right? Yeah. So I'm so glad to see you and have you here today.
Thank you so much. This has been
fun.
Thank
you so much for joining us today.